Good afternoon. I would like to call the House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 20th, and let the record reflect the time is 1 p.m. Today we have present Representative Groh, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones, otherwise you'll be bringing everyone donuts. It hasn't happened. Someone's phone needs to go off at some point. That would be fun snacks. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Talia Ames with the Juno LAO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will hear a presentation on human trafficking statistics by Alaska Department of Public Safety, Ms. Katie Tipas with the Governor's Council on Human Sex Trafficking. And the second item on the agenda, in the second half hour, we will continue our work on House Bill 68, Crime of Sex and Human Trafficking, from the Governor as presented by the Criminal Division of Alaska Department of Law. I would also like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Eastman. So we will now hear a presentation on human and trafficking statistics by Ms. Katie Tipas, who's joining us over Microsoft Teams. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your presentation. Committee members should have the documents that have been sent to you and on your desks. I would like to allow her to get through the content as presented and then open it up to questions from committee members after that. Ms. Tipas.
Good afternoon.
My name is Katie Tipas. I work with the Department of Public. I am getting an echo on this side. I don't know if you all can hear that.
We cannot. Your sound coming in clear for us.
Okay, then I will continue and push through that echo. So again, Katie Tipas for the record. I'm a program coordinator with the Department of Public Safety, and I work for the Director's Office of the Alaska State Troopers. This afternoon, I've been asked to talk with you specific to the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking Data Summary Document. I briefly mentioned this during my testimony last Monday. You'll be hearing from myself. I'll be providing an overview, and then we have five individuals who are going to speak to specific data sets within the document. You'll be hearing from Heather Hagelberger from Covenant House, Anna Taylor from the Alaska Institute of Justice, Kira Bishop from the Department of Juvenile Justice, Kim Gway from the Office of Children's Services, and Diane Castro from CDVSA, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Ms. Tipas, I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Johnson. Please continue.
Next slide. The data summary document by the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking was released on March 16th. As a reminder, when I presented to you last time, the council was requested as part of their duties under the administrative order to look at gaps in trafficking information and data. We defined those gaps in the report, and we had specific action items attached to those gaps. One of the action items was to compile all existing data sets in one location. We formed a data subcommittee, and this subcommittee worked together over a fairly short period of time to compile the data summary document. Next slide. This is a copy of the cover sheet of the data summary document. This is now posted under DPS's or on DPS's website under the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. It is a public document and available. Within this document, you will find data from the following entities. I would like to remind this committee that the data sets are specific to each agency. So if you have questions on those data sets, we would refer you back to the agency that owns that data. They're the ones who check the reliability and the validity of the data. The data subcommittee compiled the data, but each individual entity owns that data. So we have data sets from Love Alaska Priceless, My House, Covenant House, the Alaska Institute for Justice. And today you will be hearing specifically, as I stated before, from Covenant House and the Alaska Institute for Justice. We have data from the National Human Trafficking Hotline, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and Alaska Department of Health, Alaska Department of Public Safety, Alaska Department of Law, and Departments of Juvenile Justice and OCS. I think we might need to be on the next slide if Lisa hasn't forwarded that. We also have data from the Federal Bureau of Investigations, Anchorage Police Department. So those are all the entities that we have. Next slide. As I've stated, and this is really important, each agency verified their own data. Please send your questions on any data sets to each respective agency. And the definitions do vary. Each entity may be using a different definition. So when you look at the data summary document, at the top of each data set will be definitions that that entity used or uses. So we have state definitions of domestic violence under our statutes. There are federal definitions that were used. And then some entities use their own definitions. So please look at those unique definitions. The last thing I'd like to say is this data starts to paint a picture of human and sex trafficking in Alaska, human and labor trafficking in Alaska. We have not dove deep into the data. We do not have trends to provide to you right now. My hope, our hope, is that the data subcommittee will continue their work. Our desire is to compile a document that can be published each year. As we continue to work on it, we hope to continue to improve each data set and ultimately have trends that we can provide to you. I'd like to turn it over now to Heather Hagelberger from Covenant House.
Thank you, Katie. So for the record, my name is Heather Hagelberger with Covenant House Alaska. I am the Trafficking Prevention and Intervention Program Manager here, and I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to testify here this afternoon. So the data on this slide, it was collected from July 1st, 2021 to July 1st, 2022. In total, we had 203 unduplicated youths who were screened for trafficking, and that was for sex or labor trafficking. We utilized a screening tool out of Covenant House, New Jersey, called the Quick Youth Indicators for Trafficking, or the QYIT. And this is a four-question tool that was developed specifically for homeless youth ages 18 to 24. Out of that screening tool, we had 74 who answered at least one question affirmatively, which then triggered the next step, which was an assessment called the Trafficking Victims Identification Tool out of the Vera Institute. From there, we had 22 youth who were identified as having likely or certainly experienced sex trafficking, and we had 4 youth who were identified as having experienced labor trafficking. Some additional information about our data from Covenant House. We have recognized that there are 3 factors that contribute to working towards stability for our youth. From that, those 3 factors are based on permanent connections, disabling conditions, and income. Of these, 75% of the victims that we are working with through Covenant House have 2 or more of those 3 spots where they are needing some more support and assistance towards stability. And that is what I have for the slides. Are there any questions before we move on?
Seeing none, please continue.
Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Anna Taylor.
All right. Thanks so much, Heather. For the record, my name is Anna Taylor. I am the supervising attorney at the Alaska Institute for Justice, and I just want to thank the committee so much for inviting AIJ to present. AIJ provides statewide legal and language access services for underserved and limited English proficient survivors of human trafficking and other crimes. So those other crimes include crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault, and then kind of a smattering of other victimizations. As you can see from the slide presented, between January of 2020 and September of 2022, we provided over 3,000 units of legal services to survivors of human trafficking. And our organization uses the federal definition of human trafficking. We had 182 instances of labor trafficking, 75 people who experienced both labor and sex trafficking, and 16 people who experienced sex trafficking. And so that's kind of our slide presentation, and I'd like to open it up for questions.
Ms. Taylor, I'm looking at your charts before us, and my brain is trying to keep up with the numbers that you just gave us in relating it to the chart in front of us. Could you repeat what you said and just give us a further explanation of the little donuts that we're looking at?
Yes, thank you for the question, and through the chair to the representative. So the 3,000 units are, so a unit is 15 minutes of legal services. So that comes out to about 750 hours. If my math is correct, I'm an attorney, not a mathematician. So then we provided 3,465 units of legal services. So that's, most of the 750 hours of legal services. And then ongoing case management, which was 243 units. That's things like helping people find housing, connecting them with other organizations, other resources in the community that are not kind of within our purview, but we're helping people figure out their needs and where they can get those needs met. And then 80 units of interpreter and translation. So as I mentioned, a lot of our clients are limited English proficient, and so we are using our Language Interpreter Center to provide interpretation. And then the other services, that's the smallest slice of the pie there, or of the donut. Those can include, sometimes that's just emotional support. Our clients, a lot of times they've gone through a lot. They need someone to listen and understand. So we're doing some of that, and then kind of anything else that comes along. And in terms of our, I guess I can stop there. Does that answer your question, or would you like further details on that donut?
We have a question from Representative Gray.
Thank you so much. And this may, through the chair, this may be because all of our presentations have been very focused on sex trafficking. But the surprising thing about this slide is that there's so much more labor trafficking than sex trafficking. In our previous presentations, labor trafficking has been sort of just an aside, and there's only been a couple of cases. Although, when we look at the combination of sex and labor, the people who were being trafficked for labor, it looks like a lot of them were also participating in sex trafficking, but just a very small number were sex trafficked only. Are we to make any big generalizations about the sex trafficking versus labor trafficking in Alaska from this slide?
And through the chair to the representative, I'm hesitant to make any large generalizations based on, a couple pieces of data. I think that limited English proficient people are maybe more vulnerable to labor trafficking than people who grew up speaking English. So we do, I think we do see more of the labor trafficking side, but I think that's more of a reflection of kind of the services that we offer and the work that we do. I don't think it's necessarily a generalization to be made across the population.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Could you provide, like on that the lower donut with that's labeled labor, it says N equals 182. What does that number reflect?
Yes, and through the chair, that is, it's different types of victimization. So it's not necessarily the number of victims, because some victims or survivors have experienced multiple types of victimization. So, for example, somebody could have been trafficked in a field labor situation and then also in a cleaning services situation. So it's kind of discrete instances of victimization.
Okay, any further questions for Ms. Taylor? Thank you. Thank you for presenting this information and the services that you provide.
Okay, thanks so much.
For the record, this is Katie Tipas. I'm now going to pass the computer over here to our next presenter.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kira Bishop. I'm the Deputy Director of Alaska Division of Juvenile Justice. Thank you for inviting me to be here today. I'm going to speak on the data that Division of Juvenile Justice, DJJ, did provide to the data subcommittee. DJJ as a whole is moving over many years towards trauma-informed care and addressing care with kids and the ACEs they experience. Excuse the frog in my throat. And in 2020, we did implement a trauma screening tool for the youth that enter our detention or are adjudicated or on formal diversion and probation. So this slide is representing the data that we have from that implementation in 2020. There is one specific question on the trauma screening tool, which is a 15-question screening that, as I mentioned, really does address all the different ACEs. So it asks questions about physical, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, neglect, all of the things that we know affect how kids interact. In the data that's presented on the slide, we have the total amount of juveniles screened. That is not unduplicated. So there is some duplication in those numbers. So therefore, the number of yes that are answered could be duplicated. We don't know for sure. We haven't been able to dig that deep into the data. But the question specifically that we do ask is, have you ever traded sex for anything such as food, shelter, drugs, alcohol, or a ride? And we can see there that in 2020, we had 21 yes responses. In 21, we had 19. And in FY22, we had 10. Is there any follow-up questions for what data is presented here?
Representative Groh.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just curious. It says, have you ever traded sex for anything such as food, shelter, drugs, alcohol, or a ride? Is money a different question?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, that is a good question. I think we just provided examples. So I would have to dig deeper into that and figure out why we worded it that way.
This is a keen observation, Representative Gray, that I, in looking at the bill, we have a lot of definitions around prostitution and around what that engagement looks like. And, through our recent testimony, is that a lot of times there was an exchange for drugs. And I think these are very pertinent questions that we have to get down to the nuance of being trafficked and what actual exchange is taking place on the streets versus what we think may be happening. The question that I have is on the number of juveniles screened, the purple bar there. We see an increase in numbers. Where are those numbers derived from? Do you screen all of the juveniles that come through? Is there just a portion that you screen? Why are we seeing a higher number of screening?
Thank you, Chair. So to what I can say is I can tell you who we screen. I'd have to dig deeper to figure out why those numbers are increasing. So every youth that enters a DJJ detention facility that stays longer than 24 hours is screened. And then any youth that is on probation that receives a formal adjudication, which is similar in the juvenile world, that's essentially a conviction, or is put on formal diversion, or has a adjudication held in abeyance, is also screened, as well as any youth that enter DJJ's secure treatment facilities are screened. So because that data in the purple there is duplicated youth, there could be youth that have been screened multiple times because they've been rescreened at different points in the DJJ system.
Okay, thank you. That does give us a little bit of a picture. Just for clarification on understanding, what is the age, the maximum age to be considered a juvenile in DJJ?
We take referrals. For us, a referral only comes from law enforcement, a law enforcement agency. So any police report is a referral. And so we take referrals up until the age of 18. However, should a youth already be on supervision of some nature in juvenile justice, we then extend jurisdiction through courts, normally till 19 and in some specific cases 20.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So through the chair, I'm wondering if you have a theory, and I understand that there could be some duplication in the screening and in the answers, but it appears that as the years go by, we are screening more and more youth, and the number of yes responses is going down. Can you maybe theorize why we're seeing less yes responses the more youth we ask?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I really do not have an answer to that question. As Katie Tipas mentioned, this is really, we are just starting to look at this data. And because this is a fairly new screening instrument for DJJ as a whole, we haven't been able to do that dig yet.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Going back to a previous question, the way that you've worded your question on the trauma screening tool seems a bit ambiguous in that I think from the testimony that we have heard, not only are individuals trading sex for things and for money, of course, but also for non-things, i.e., in an effort to avoid being physically assaulted, I think was one of the things that came up repeatedly in testimony. And I'm wondering if you have any other questions that might capture that element of that behavior.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, let me take a look. As I mentioned, it is a 15-question screening. So there are questions that are asking if you've been touched, grabbed, threatened, ever, never had enough to eat, put you emotional neglect, such as putting you down, humiliation. So, there's quite a few questions. Questions regarding if you've ever been pushed, grabbed, not specific to asking about for sex, but in general.
Okay.
Any further questions for Ms. Bishop? Seeing none, thank you so much for giving that to us. And then once again, I think this data was just compiled last week. So it is hot off the press, and I look forward to further analysis of this. Ms. Tipas, please continue.
I'll pass the computer off to Kim Gui.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kim Gui. I'm the director of Office of Children's Services. On the slide that you have there in front of you is a five-year look of some data that OCS has collected. I kind of want to point out the difference in some of the data that is being presented, and there's some data that also is in the report that Ms. Tipas referenced earlier in this presentation. This early data is about reports that are coming into the Office of Children's Services in regards to trafficking. And so how and what that looks like at OCS is we get reports of sex abuse, and typically, unless it's a caregiver or a parent that is sexually abusing a child or trafficking a child, that information would get screened over to law enforcement. We screen in and investigate cases if it is a parent or caretaker that is, in this instance, if they're trafficking their own child. We also screen in reports if the child that is alleged to be trafficked is a foster child. And so some of this data, you will kind of see some differences. And so the total reports over 5 years, we received 296 reports of children being alleged to be trafficked. And how that comes in, we investigate and look at reports according to the statutory authority, which is on physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, or mental injury. And under those categories, they have what we call characteristics. And those characteristics, there is a box that says trafficked. And so for a parent, for example, it may be neglect with a trafficking allegation, if that's what the concern is. If it is someone that is not a parent or caregiver that is trafficking, sorry, this gets kind of complex, it would be sex abuse trafficking. And so there's a little bit of differences and nuances to that. It can get a little confusing. But you will see that we had a total cases of 266 cases that came in with concerns of trafficking, with a total children count of 55. And again, those could be children that have been counted more than once on different allegations. It could also be the same incident, but more than one reporter. But this distinct children of trafficking over this five-year period was 47. And there were 60 investigations done by OCS. And I'll pause there for some questions.
Wonderful time to pause. Can you tell us the distinction between total cases and total children? Because in my mind, I would equate a case to a child. But can you talk about the difference in those numbers that we see?
Yes, definitely. So the difference in those numbers is a case is typically belongs to a parent. And so boy, this gets nuanced. If it's parents are together, that's one case. If parents aren't together and the child is in both households, it could be both parents have their own case. If a child doesn't have parents, their rights have been terminated, the child has their own case. And so that's the, I mean, there are cases and then there are reports that come underneath the case. And then there's kids that are associated with that report and with that case. And so the total children on here or the distinct children are the actual individual children that have been reported to be trafficked under that family characteristic that I mentioned. I'm sorry, it's pretty confusing. Sometimes I think it's easier to diagram maybe on a whiteboard to understand our system a little bit.
I think you just said it, but would you describe, you have total children, 55. And what's the definition of the distinct children at 47?
Yes, Chair Vance. The distinct children are the actual individual children, that which is 47. 55 could be the same child who's been reported more often, right? So it could be numerous children that were at least reported twice, 8 more times. So that's the difference between total children and distinct children. So there's a duplication of at least 8 kids, okay. 8 youth.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I know that every case is distinct, but I'm wondering if you could make some generalizations about who the typical reporter is of sex trafficking, whether it be another family member, a neighbor, a teacher. Just can you speak in general about who generally reports these cases?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, typically law enforcement is our reporter, and right next to law enforcement typically is family members or close friends of the family that are concerned about the youth.
One of the questions that came up in our previous hearings is, are the people who work in the Office of Children's Services trained to be able to identify trafficking, the characteristics of trafficking?
Chair Vance, they do receive training. Although I will say, do I feel like it's sufficient? No, it probably needs to be beefed up a little bit. They do receive, our investigators receive a 40-hour training on forensic interviewing. But we also have some webinars and on-demand trainings about trafficking and in regards to prudent parent standards. So we do have minimal training. I wouldn't say it's enough. What we do, we have some safeguards in place. For example, if we have a foster youth that is on runaway status, and then they are found, whether it's within 24 hours or 5 days later, our intake staff, once they're found, sends our line staff the questions that they need to be screening for any child who's been on runaway status, because we are concerned why they ran away, what happened when they ran away, and what kind of services that we need to be changing or doing for that youth. And so we do try to, we do have a system in place for foster youth, but we did identify that more should be done on trafficking.
Wonderful. Any further questions for Ms. Gui? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Good afternoon. For the record, Diane Casto, Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I think what we can see in general about the data we have for sex and human trafficking right now, it's limited. And that all of us have made a little bit of inroads into collecting this data, but there is no really consistent data across the board. So I just like to state that, because as I was looking at our data and then looking at the rest of the data, there, as we've said, and as Ms. Tipas said, there's really no good way to compare it, 1 year data versus 5 year data. So hopefully this conversation can get us moving in a direction of having better data. So with that said, I guess one other thing I want to remind people, slides that are shown are just a snippet of what's in the full report. So there are additional charts in the report, just so you know that. And we just wanted to keep it as concise as possible. So for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, our reporting starts on page 14 and goes, I think, through 16. So there's a few more slides that you, if you're interested. So first of all, what I would say is the Council on Domestic Violence, as you know, does provide services to victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence. Most of our victim service programs, that's a category, our grant category, are shelter, emergency shelter programs that also provide advocacy and some counseling and legal services, some other things. But primarily it's safety. It's getting victims and survivors into safe spaces to heal, to regroup, to figure out what their next steps are. Our programs in general have not been seen, I don't believe, as a natural referral for victims of domestic or sexual and human trafficking for many of the reasons that were presented last week during the many presentations you had, is that there's a fear factor there that, you know, not wanting to get caught, not wanting to tell their story, all of the things that keep them from reaching out to programs. So I think as some of our presenters on Wednesday talked about, a lot of it is helping find individuals as opposed to the individuals coming to our services. So I just want to kind of state that as well, because I would like to see more people be able to reach out to our programs. I just don't think it's happening. So I also did provide a copy of our 2022 annual report, and starting on page 21 is our data for all of our services. And I wanted to do that because to put this data into perspective, we see a very, very small number. As you can see on the chart that's shown, up to 30 people is the top. We, in our 2022 unduplicated data of services provided, we provided services to 8,761 individuals. Unduplicated individuals. If you look then in the this report, you can see the level, the different kinds of services that are offered and the different kinds of threats that individuals are receiving that brings them to our programs. So with that said, we see a very tiny number of those who indicate to us or to our programs that they are victims of sex and human trafficking. Do I believe there are more? I do. But I think one of the things we don't do, and it's been talked about, we have not really done a good job of having good screening tools. And I think some of those are fairly new. People are starting to use them. Clearly, that's an area that we need to amp up in our work to make sure that we are able to know when someone has been trafficked. But at the same time, I would say some of the services we provide are probably not as appropriate initially for someone just coming out of a sex trafficking or human trafficking situation, just because, again, the things that were talked about. But with that said, we are there to provide services as best we can. We're there to offer people resources. We're there to make sure that they do have a safe place to stay, even if it's very temporary. So with that said, I think there are things, a couple things I just want to talk about regarding that. The data is limited. Our screening for this specific situation is limited. And there are many that are, again, that are just not indicating that this is a situation. So we have limited ability to reach out and help them in the way that they really need help. A couple of things that we have done that I think are going to help, and we have talked about this, again, all last week and some of the data today, is that one of the vulnerabilities for individuals is a lack of English, being a non-English-speaking individual. The Council on Domestic Violence is part of our outreach to make sure our services are more accessible. We have just completed a project where we translated all of our service information into an interactive process where individuals can go to that site. We have translated all of the service data into Spanish, Hmong, Korean, Tagalog, Yupik, Russian, Samoan, and Chinese. Those are the 8 top languages that are spoken in Alaska. Our hope is that we can really start reaching people who feel trapped for that reason, that they can't reach out because they have limited English or no English at all, and so they get even more trapped than what sometimes happens. So that's one thing that I'm hoping that as we get that up and really running, it's on our website, but not fully operational. We're pushing the button very soon to really make that. But people can actually go in there. They can find their language. They can find out which programs have a staff that speak that language. Or we're also in working with ANDVSA, making sure that our program funded programs have access to translators and can get the services interpreters and translators that individuals need to fully express themselves and be able to get the services they need. With those changes, I think we can start seeing improvement in the number of people that can reach out for these services and that we can provide adequate services to. So I know I didn't talk too much about the data per se because it's pretty limited, but I do think if you look at the data in our annual report, again, starting on page 21, I think. Let me just check that really quickly. 21 through 25, it gives you an idea of who is coming to our programs, what their main service request is, what are they receiving from us, and then how do we start building that to actually make sure that there are appropriate services for everyone who needs to reach out for services. Thank you.
Thank you, and I just like to let the members know that Ms. Casto provided this blue report to us today, and we will be sending a digital copy for you this week as well. Could you just explain this graph that we're seeing here? Now, the green is South Central. Do those numbers include Anchorage or exclude? So Anchorage has its own, and then I assume it's all the other communities of South Central on the green?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. Anchorage is its own because that's where the majority of our data often comes from. So that is there alone, the Anchorage Bowl area, and then all the outlying communities are the rest of South Central.
So I know that you just got this information, but you can imagine my concern being from South Central that the green bar of South Central saw an increase in 2020 mm-hmm. while a dramatic decrease in Anchorage. Do you have any idea of what that could be?
Madam Chair, I wish I did. And this is what, as I was reviewing the data after we kind of got it out and got to see everyone's data, one of the things that I was hoping for, because the other question I have is the big purple increase in the Anchorage area. What caused that? What was going on at that time? Why? So I don't know specifically, but I think it's something those are the kind of things that we really need to look at, because oftentimes something will happen in a community or in a change of a piece of legislation or a change in the policing in a community, or, you know, just so many things that could change that cause these unexpected or unexplained bumps, either bumps or decreases. So I totally agree with you. I would love to know that. And I think what we are going to have to do is go back and look at our data more thoroughly and see if we can identify why, as well as identify why Anchorage saw a huge increase and then a huge decline. There's something that has caused it, obviously, but I don't know that we have the information to really clarify that. And that is part of what we need to do in terms of being able to take all this disparate data and start making sense of it so that we see a picture. And so if I had data from all the other programs for 2020, then we might be able to see, is that consistently happening in other places as well, or is it just this data?
One of the lenses that I think is going to need an overlay is COVID and suspension of services for a time and the impact that could have made to people just coming across your doorstep. And that's one of my larger concerns during COVID and all the masking was trafficking, because you wouldn't be able to see the expression on someone's face if they were in fear or, just being passed off as someone else or things like that. That was a big concern of mine. And I'm even more concerned seeing that there was an increase in my region during that time. But it's a very interesting graph. And like I mentioned previously, we look forward to further analysis of this. But I see we have questions.
Can I just quickly respond to something you said? I apologize, but I think it is important to the COVID question, because we actually did a little bit of analysis of our data during COVID. And not only were we seeing fewer people coming to services, but our services, as you can imagine, had to readjust, because in an emergency shelter, you often have 3-4 people to a room. You know, you have bunk beds and you have kids in the room with the adults. And because of the distancing and our programs had to change how they set people up. And so it reduced their bed space as well. Now, with that said, they had funds to find alternative, you know, lodging if there was a hotel or some kind of place. But it truly impacted our program significantly in congregate living situations. So I just wanted to say that.
Yes, thank you for that. Representative Groh.
Thank you, Chair Vance. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Castro. And I want to thank everybody who's testified today or last week on this very troubling topic. And I wanted to add a question about the statistics. The trafficking stories that we heard were obviously horrific, and it's obviously terrible. I just want to talk a little about the numbers, and I'm looking at page 21 of 32 of this report, and I'm trying to compare it to page 11 of this, the handout, right? And if I'm making sense here.
Yeah.
So, and I'm just trying to do the arithmetic quickly here, and I'm looking at 2022, which I assume is fiscal year 2022, mm-hmm. here, and that's similar. It looks like it's SFY or
state fiscal year.
State fiscal year. Got it. Making sure I'm talking the same thing. 2022 here in page 21, and if I'm counting right, and I just want to make sure I'm getting this right, and if I'm comparing the categories correctly, and that's why I wanted to make sure I asked you. It appears as though there were in the order of 250 times more cases of family violence/domestic violence than sex trafficking. I'm comparing the number of family violence/domestic violence of 5,155 on page 21 of 32 of your annual report with, I'm adding up quickly and getting to 19 if I'm counting on page 11. Am I making sense here?
Through the chair, you're making sense, but I don't think they're comparable.
Okay.
Because what I would say is the data in here is for all of individuals that come through the doors of our subgrantees. This data is a very small piece, and as I started out, it's about a third of a percent of our overall people that we serve. So it's a very tiny. So is it represented in here? It is in the numbers, but as you can see, when we served many more people, and the victimizations that are identified, the five most common, do not include trafficking. Okay. So trafficking is not really highlighted here. It's in the numbers, but it would be, you know, for instance, 20, 10, 5 people in comparison to 7,366 for this grant program. So I don't think they're very comparable.
Okay, follow up. Thank you, Chair Vance. You've been in this field for some years. We've had the opportunity to come and talk to my office, been kind enough to. You've been in the field how many years now?
Well, I started in child abuse and neglect prevention in 1978.
Okay. And then
so
you've
been here a while.
And you've worked in the field of preventing domestic violence and sexual assault for a number of years.
Yes, I've been at the council for almost 6 years.
There you go. I'm just going to ask a more general question if I could. Is it generally true that domestic violence/domestic violence, this category, is substantially more common in Alaska than sex trafficking or human trafficking, in your experience or observation?
Through the chair, again, a hard question to ask because I don't think we're seeing it. Okay. I think through the last few years, we've started getting more recognition of it, but I don't believe that as a state we can say it's growing. It's because we don't know, because we haven't really paid attention to the data for many reasons that we don't. This is a hidden crime. It is. That's how it thrives. It's underground. It's fear based. It's not something that we've had good, clear data to document what is happening. Do I think we have a serious problem? I absolutely do. And I think the last week indicated that. Is it time that we have more attention to this issue? Absolutely. And hopefully the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking, the role they can play is to really keep the focus on this and to help all of the people, the service organizations that do see this population, start collecting better data, doing better screening, and really paying attention to what's happening. Because I was the director of DFYS so many years ago, back in 95. And that was, at that time, we had both DJJ and OCS combined into one. And was this on our radar? Not really. I mean, it occasionally would come through, but it was not something that was truly on our radar. So we've come a great, great distance in recognition and paying attention to this issue in the last number of years. But we have a long way to go.
Follow-up?
Yes, Chairman. And I do think that's sort of a tricky thing here, because obviously the human and sex trafficking and the various trafficking cases we've heard about, as I said before, are horrific and terrible. And it just, in my experience as a prosecutor like you, I have not done this kind of work since the 1990s, and I started the 1980s myself. But it seems to me that cases of family and domestic violence are, you know, there's a lot of it that can occur, and it's easier in the sense that it does not involve some of the more sophisticated arrangements that we've heard about in the testimony, as well as adult sexual and adult physical assault, in the sense that there's less sophistication involved. And obviously these sophisticated crimes can occur, and we've heard about them. But I do want to point out that it just seems, based on what I've observed, that there's a lot of crime of a domestic and slash family violence and sexual assault and physical assault that would occur outside of the context of trafficking we've heard so much about recently. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Kesto? Thank you. I would like to note that we are in the process of making arrangements to have the council back with us on Friday, because there is a great portion of House Bill 68 that has some proposed changes, and I want to make sure that we understand the work of the council, the proposals that are before us in that bill, and being able to have that conversation. So if you have more questions in regards to the changes that the bill brings, please have those prepared for Friday.
Thank you. I look forward to it, Madam Chair. And I believe now Katie Tipas is going to close us out on this presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Katie Tipas. If you have the document in front of you, and by document I mean the data summary document, I'm on page 27. You can go to the next slide, Lisa. We decided as the data subcommittee that we wanted to provide not just data on human and sex trafficking from the entities that I mentioned, several of whom you've heard before, but we also wanted to include several potential or risk factors. So we do have data in the document on runaways. We believe that runaways are at high risk of trafficking. Obviously, I think everybody on the committee understands the vulnerabilities that runaways have and face. So we have data from OCS, APD, and AST on runaways. I can only speak for AST. I don't believe that we are specifically screening runaway juveniles for sex trafficking. I think one of our greatest needs, and this is one of the recommendations from the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking, is to develop screening tools for specific entities and to have some consistency across disciplines with those screening tools so we can potentially compare.
So we have data there that you see on page 30 and 31. And then we also have data on ACEs. ACEs are adverse childhood experiences. I'm looking at page 33. For those of you that are interested in digging in a little bit deeper and seeing the linkages between ACEs, again, adverse childhood experiences and trafficking, there are some citations at the bottom of page 33 on the left-hand side, specifically footnote 1 and 2. And so ACEs most certainly are linked pretty heavily to trafficking. So we have that information for you here that was prepared by Department of Health, and that's page 32 and 33 of the data summary document. And then we also have another data set for you, and that is from the Alaska Victimization Survey, that known as the AVS. And this was done in 2010, 2015, and 2020. In 2020, there was an additional data set that was added to the ACEs looking at mental health trust beneficiaries. I don't know if we have time. I'm looking at the clock to have Ms. Castro come up and talk about that. I don't think we do, but I do encourage the committee to look at that data. As Heather Hagelberger from Covenant House mentioned, when you're looking at, again, those youth risk factors, substance abuse, mental health issues are definitely a risk factor. And so we see, again, high rates of victimization with potential mental health trust beneficiaries, higher vulnerability than those who do not fit under the trust beneficiary status. So the document, again, contains those risk factors. And I'd like to close in saying a couple very specific things just to remind the committee about. As Diane's talked about, all of us has talked about, we have some data. Is it as robust as we would like? No, it's not. But we want to be able to continue that work. In order to continue that work, we very much believe that the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking has to continue. Right now, it's under an administrative order. One of the recommendations from the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking is to put that specific council in statute. So that is one of the recommendations so that the work can continue. And the other thing, again, I can't stress it enough, is that we need to work on screening tools so we can further identify people. So Representative Groh has asked very good questions about the rates and how do they compare. And the reality is we know some information, but we most certainly don't know everything because we have not developed robust screening tools, or at least many entities haven't. I'd like to shout out to Covenant House, who definitely is using a robust screening tool, and some other entities as well. And then the absolute reality is that many victims of sex trafficking don't necessarily perceive themselves as victims of sex trafficking. They might perceive it to be a DV relationship. And so I think a lot of people who are experiencing domestic violence, it could be potentially DV, but we haven't necessarily asked the right questions to differentiate between, is this what I would call a traditional DV case, or is it a trafficking case? And so we have to really try to differentiate between those. So my guess is there's a lot of overlap between the data. And the other thing I'd like to say, and I'm very grateful that AIJ, the Alaska Institute for Justice, was able to present, because they have the trafficking data that exists other than the small percentage that Covenant House presented on. And one of the other recommendations from the council, and specifically the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking, is to add Department of Labor to the council. So if for some reason it does go into statute, I think we would like to see labor as a council member. And in addition, we don't have representation from DJJ or OCS, and so it would be good to have representation from their department. And that was in part because of the split with HESS, and so just want to close on that so we can have people who are at the table making the decisions so that we can, again, further the conversation. And lastly, I'd like to thank Chair Vance, Representative Vance, for her continued action on this. I think your legacy is going to be one of action versus what we've seen of inaction. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Tipas. I do have a couple of questions regarding your closing comments, and I'm going to kind of put you on the spot a little bit, so I hope you're ready. On the recommendation is that the the Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking continue and hopefully in statute. But I was looking at the proposal in House Bill 68 of expanding the role of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and the duties of that council, and wondering why there needs to be both. So could you please clarify for us why you recommend continuing the work that the Governor's Council has done versus the role of the proposed expansion of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excellent question. We had a lot of conversations about this, and Ms. Castro was actively involved in those. And we were trying to differentiate between the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking and CDVSA. CDVSA, in our discussions, was willing to be an entity that could assume some granting responsibility. So specifically, if additional funds were to be added towards potentially, for example, some PSAs, some prevention work on this issue, maybe victim services, funding through the council, they already have that structure set up to grant money out to entities. If you were to give that responsibility of doing grants through the Council on Human Sex Trafficking, you would have to significantly increase staffing. So right now, the staffing for the Council on Human Sex Trafficking is done through the department. We didn't receive any additional funds for that. And so I have done it as another duty is assigned, and we've had a couple other people help out. And so we wanted the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking to be this umbrella entity that was helping continue to move things forward and doing monitoring of projects, but not necessarily the granting or specifically being the funder.
Thank you for that clarification. I am wanting to make sure that there are defined roles in the assigned responsibilities for each group, and that we're not continuing to have unfunded mandates and confusion as to who's going to do what. The other question that I have is something that you mentioned that at the beginning of this information, and that is regarding the differences in the definitions used by each organization. What can we do to help have a unified definition on human and sex trafficking that everyone is working from the same sheet of music?
Excellent question, Madam Chair. I think a couple things. One is I think we have to consider that we might never get to one specific definition because we do have state and federal, and those definitions, generally speaking, follow criminal statutes. So I'll give you an example outside of sex trafficking. I think, as you know, do a lot of training on domestic violence. The state of Alaska has a very specific definition of domestic violence under 1866-990. It defines the crimes and the relationships, and that is what makes DV. So we look at AST's data in our cases. It's reflective of those charges. When you talk to domestic violence programs, victim service programs, they might not be using the state definition. And so I think one of the points I want to make or share with you is that I don't know whether we're going to get to 100% one definition, because we often don't. But I think if we can be descriptive in the data we're sharing, that's great. Separately, I do think we can be more consistent with our screening tools. So if we're using the same questions in our screening tools, specific to youth and adults, and if we're screening with those same questions, I think we can get to greater consistency regarding that.
Thank you. The last question that I have, I don't mean to hog the questions, is this the first time that data across the organizations has been compiled in one place?
The task force from 2013 did have a report that they generated, and they did interview a lot of key stakeholders regarding their data. So that document does have some data. Of interest, if you look at that document, I believe AST had zero cases. That data was collected at a time that we didn't have our special investigative unit.
And so another thing to always consider is as you build services, then often we are able to identify victims and people do come forward when there's more services.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is Gwen Adams still available? Or was she ever available?
For the record, this is Katie Tipas. I do not believe that we have Ms. Adams online today.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is on the Love Alaska. It's like the page 3. It says 20% of clients have pursued justice as defined above and reported the crimes against them. Zero have been successfully pursued and prosecuted. So we've had zero prosecutions?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I believe specific to that, those are the clients that they've served. Those clients, Ms. Adams, did not receive justice. There could be other individuals who are victims or survivors of sex trafficking, and their cases did go through the criminal justice system and were prosecuted. So I think differentiating between that particular client population and others who may have reported to law enforcement who did see a prosecution result from their case.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, what we're trying to do here is to get to the perpetrators. And if we're looking at a situation, regardless of what population you're looking at, where you've got zero prosecutions out of 20% of the total populations, I want to make sure that what we're doing here is going to allow the state to get at those perpetrators. I don't want to have 100 survivors and zero prosecutors, because that doesn't serve our purpose here today. So I just wanted to point that out in the document. I was kind of perusing through it, went very quickly. But I think that we need to focus on getting justice for these victims.
I agree, Representative Johnson. And as soon as Department of Law finishes up in the other body, they will be here to begin the work on that. Oh, they are out there. We are going to have on cue. We're going to have that conversation in what that looks like as proposed in House Bill 68. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Tipas? Okay. Thank you so much for all of you and your work on this and compiling this information and continued analysis and most importantly, servicing those who have been victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, trafficking, the homeless, and all of the people that you serve. Thank you so much. We will now take a brief at ease to transition to our next presentation. Back on record, on our final agenda item today is House Bill 68, Crime of Sex and Human Trafficking, from the Governor as presented by the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law. And committee members should have before them a highlighted document that was provided this morning. I would now like to welcome Deputy Attorney General Mr. John Skidmore to walk us through this document and entertain questions. Thank you so much for compiling this document to help us understand this 30-page bill and the definitions. And because I want us to continue to lay a really good foundation and understand the nuances, if you could just walk us through each of these sections, and I think the questions will come. So if you could go through a section, wherever you feel comfortable is a place to pause, to open up for questions, I will let you drive this conversation.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. And the document that you all should have in front of you that's also up here on the screen is a two-page or one-page front and back attempt to summarize some of what's in the bill. The first place I'm going to start with is footnote number 1, which says that this sheet provides a broad overview of HB 68 and is not comprehensive. It is not meant to serve as legal advice or opinion, and it is not a substitute for an independent review of HB 68. So we've generally tried to summarize to help you all gather what's going on in one place to make it easier to digest. But to the extent that you have further questions, I would implore you to go back to the legislation itself for any specific questions. With that in mind, I'm going to start on page one in the left-hand column where it talks about sex trafficking. And what this column does is it lays out sex trafficking in the first degree, in the second degree, and in the third degree. And for each of those, it attempts to first tell you the classification of the felony. Remember that there are four different levels of felonies, C, B, A, and unclassified, in that order from least serious to most. It also denotes that they are sex felonies, and in our law, what that means is two things. One, it means that they are sentenced under a different sentencing provision, subsection I of Alaska Statute 1255-125, which is where our sentencings are found and authorized. And subsection I is a specific carve-out for sex offenses with greater penalties associated with them. The second thing it means is for sex felonies, and not all of these will fall into this category, but some of them then are registrable. And what I mean by that is sex trafficking in the first degree and the second degree are registrable offenses, but sex trafficking in the third degree does not end up being a registrable offense. And the reason that policy decision was made is that in the third degree, that's really trying to address those individuals that are providing services or resources or other assistance. That is, they are not doing the trafficking themselves, but rather think of them as the corollary or the supporting characters, if you will, in what happens with sex trafficking. And so they were not going to be required to register as sex offenders. In walking through that left-hand column, you start with in the first degree and the parts that are in bold. You see that the person in bold induces or causes another person to engage in a commercial sex act. That particular term is bolded because it's defined elsewhere through the use of force or the threat of force against any person. And that's really what distinguishes sex trafficking in the first degree from second, is that use or that threatened use of force. The second subsection of sex trafficking in the first degree talks about, again, inducing or causing, again, with a commercial sexual act, someone under the age of 20, or is that person's legal custodian or legal guardian. Those are, again, elevated because you're dealing with someone of a younger age that's either been coerced, induced, or caused to engage in that, or in which the individual is the legal custodian or guardian. And then the third subsection really talks about a couple of concepts that are left over from promoting prostitution. And that is, talks about a person that manages, supervises, controls, or owns, either alone or in association with others, a prostitution enterprise or a place of prostitution. Again, prostitution enterprise and place of prostitution are bolded. The reason for that is that when we get to the second page of this document, it provides definitions. And frequently what's important in understanding legislation is to make sure you look at the definitions. If you don't look at the definitions, you can get confused and there can be inconsistencies or misunderstandings of what the legislation is really attempting to do. Sex trafficking in the second degree then talks about the intent to promote sex trafficking, and a person induces or causes another person to engage in, again, commercial sex acts. So this is what I would consider all other types of inducing or causing when it is not involving force or when the victim is not under the age of 20. That's really the distinction between the first and the second. And then I've already talked about the third.
We have a question from Representative Carpenter.
Sure.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, is there, when we talk about induce or cause, physically or not physically, where does using a controlled substance, either providing it to a person or forcing them to take it, fall into the force or not force category?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, it would not be part of force. It would be in the other elements of induce or cause, and where you're going to specifically find that, I'm going to move to the second page, if I can, for just a moment. And if you look at the bottom of the second page, you see inducing or causing, and we list seven different factors of the way somebody can be induced or caused. That's actually written into the statutes. It's a different statute number that follows the sex trafficking statutes, and I can point to that place in the bill if it's helpful to you, but we lay out those seven factors as the types of things that a person engages in to induce or cause. And you'll see that specifically the controlled substances is subsection 6 on that list of seven things. and that would be induce or cause, but it's not force. Force is otherwise defined in Alaska Statute 1181-900, subsection B, and forgive me if I don't remember the exact subsection beyond that, but force is defined there, and it talks about bodily impact.
One quick follow-up. Is there another statute that makes it a crime to provide a controlled substance to a person or to force them to take that controlled substance?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, it is a crime to provide controlled substances to other people. Those controlled substances have to be listed on one of the schedules. That's found in Alaska Statute 1171. And then there's a series there. I don't remember all the other statutes within that, but those are the statutes that deal with the distribution of drugs and providing them to somebody else. The difference between that and the sex trafficking or human trafficking, where these elements of inducing or causing are found, is that simply providing a controlled substance to another person is in and of itself a crime. But when it's done for the purpose of inducing or causing them to engage in sex trafficking or human trafficking, that then elevates the offense because there's another, what we refer to as an element that's also present, and that makes it a more serious crime.
In the follow-up, Madam Chair, is there a distinction between providing and forcing someone to take the controlled substance as far as the element of the crime and a severity of the punishment?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, our drug statutes simply talk about providing them to someone else. I'm not sure that there's something that talks about forcing someone to take a drug. I feel like there's been a conversation in the last month that I've had with someone about types of statutes that might be addressing that, but I'm not recalling it off the top of my head if there's another statute that would specifically address that. There's nothing that immediately comes to mind, but I know it's an issue that's been out there, and I'm just not remembering the analysis.
Follow up?
Just to clarify, if somebody did force somebody to take drugs,
mm-hmm.
they would also be guilty of providing them.
Without question.
Thank you.
If I'm tracking Representative Carpenter, in this thought is some of the testimony provided by one of our survivors on Friday mentioned that originally she was taking the drugs, but then after a time didn't want the drugs anymore, and they ended up injecting her with the substance to continue the trafficking. And if I'm tracking correctly, that's kind of that nuance that we're looking for, that clearly that is against that person's will, and are we addressing that in statute?
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and I would need to think about that a little bit more. The first thing that comes to my mind is that could qualify certainly as an assault in addition to a misconduct involving controlled substance, so you could have both counts that are provided. They have different elements, so you could convict them of both. And then we'd argue with the court about whether or not those sentences is merged, because whether or not they deal with different societal interests. That's a whole other legal discussion that I don't want to go down that path right now, because I think it's not helpful at this moment. But assault is the first thing that comes to my mind. Whether there are additional crimes that could potentially be used, I would need to take some time and reflect on that and go through all the statutes, which is typically what a prosecutor does when they're presented with new conduct. It's not infrequently. We pull out the statute book and we start to flip through and see, do we think a particular crime applies? And you have to analyze all the elements.
Thank you for that, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Yeah, I certainly see that injection would qualify for assault. What I'm looking for is something in addition to assault once the drug is actually administered in that case. Is there something that we have in statute currently or in the bill that captures that second action?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, again, it would be the same answer. I don't know as I sit here at this moment if I could identify something else. I'd have to spend that time and reflect with the statute books. But certainly part of the assault would be the needle, if that's the way in which it's being introduced into the person's system. There are other ways in which you could cause a drug to be introduced into a person's system, but the impact of the drug would then have significance for the degree or the level of assault. And what I mean by that is that lower level assaults talk about a physical injury, which is simply pain. However, a more serious assault requires serious physical injury. That's a term that's defined in statute, and we would have to analyze whether or not the drugs amounted to a serious physical injury for the impact they had. And that's going to be a case-by-case analysis of what the facts specifically tell us.
Thank you.
Please continue on the columns.
So I'm going to go back to page one. We've talked about sex trafficking in the left-hand column, the far left-hand column. I'm going to move slightly to the right to the next one, which is a patron of a victim of sex trafficking. This, again, follows the same pattern of providing the classification of the offense. It indicates that these are sex felonies, so they would be subject to those greater penalties that I discussed in subsection I of 1255.125. It then tries to lay out the elements, and this says that a person solicits a commercial sex act, again, bolded because it's defined on the backside, with reckless disregard that the person engaged in the sexual act is a victim of sex trafficking. And we talked about this in the first hearing, that the person is reckless as to whether or not this person is a victim of sex trafficking. And again, in trying to determine what would they have to be reckless of, we would then go to those seven criteria that cause or induce someone to become a victim of sex trafficking, which is the lodging, the identification documents, the drugs, all of those sorts of things. Would the patron have a reckless disregard that one of those is causing this individual to engage in that conduct of sex trafficking? That's one way in which that can be addressed. The second one is subsection 2, where you have a victim that's under the age of 18, in which case what the law is essentially saying is anyone that is selling sex under the age of 18, our law will consider them to be a victim of sex trafficking, period.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm curious about if the patron were to ask the person, are you a victim of sex trafficking? And the person says no, would that be enough to say that this patron did not exhibit reckless disregard?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, that would certainly be one of the pieces of information, some of the evidence that we would consider. Would that in and of itself be sufficient? I can't answer that question in a vacuum. It's going to depend on all the other circumstances that are present in the other evidence.
So this is an area that I find interesting because from what we heard last week is that from the troopers is that their conversations with most of the Johns is that they're very unaware that the people that they are paying for sex could be victims of trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
They come armed. They know that they're likely to be robbed and things like that, but they just haven't thought about the fact that that person might be there against their will.
Mm-hmm.
That to me, in my mind, there's no excuse that you're buying sex. That's a pretty high offense to my mind. But the way this is defined is that it has to, in order to be considered a patron of trafficking, you have to exhibit either one of the seven, is that of inducing or causing, in order to fall under this category, or someone underage. What is the likelihood that a regular John, I hate to say that, of someone who is calling one of the numbers online,
mm-hmm.
Buying sex would fall under one of these seven?
Madam Chair, the difficulty with that is, I mean, you're asking me to sort of try and provide a percentage, and I can't provide you a percentage. But what I can tell you is that when that individual is purchasing sex from another person, that in and of itself is illegal. That is prostitution. That's the second half of prostitution, right? We've talked about that before. It is both the selling and the purchasing of sex. Both fall under the crime of prostitution. And I agree with you that it will be difficult to establish someone's reckless disregard. But again, as I indicated to Representative Gray, it will be a case-by-case analysis, and we'll have to look at what evidence do we have there that helps us understand that. You know, the things that I immediately come to my mind are whether or not the individual they're purchasing sex from, do they have markings on their body to indicate that they've been injected with drugs on a regular basis? Are there syringes laying around? Is there other drug paraphernalia in the room? Is there someone standing at the door with a gun that's providing, quote, security. I mean, there's a whole host of other factors that you might want to be considering. And the universe of possible combinations is almost infinite in how that might look. And so that's really why you have to look at that totality of the circumstances. And we'd have to talk about a reckless disregard. The person who says, geez, I just didn't know, that's not going to cut it. If the mental element was knowing, the definition of knowing has a part of that definition says if the person subjectively doesn't know, then you can't meet that definition of knowing. But reckless disregard, somebody saying, geez, I didn't know, is not a defense. They would have to say that they didn't recognize all of these other things. And the burden is on the state always to prove beyond a reasonable doubt those elements. So we'd have to look at all that other evidence to try and piece it together. Again, I don't think it's necessarily an easy charge for us to prove, but regardless, the conduct of purchasing sex from another is always illegal. And as we're going to talk about in the next column for prostitution, there are changes in the penalties for purchasing sex.
So for clarification, could you, so is the person who buys the sex fall under this next column under prostitution and it's just a misdemeanor, or is that the person selling the sex?
So let me go ahead and shift to the next column if I can. Then. Prostitution is a B misdemeanor when you are selling sex. What I don't think this section does, and I apologize for that, I'm recognizing it now, it does not lay out the changes in the penalties for purchasing sex, because the changes that occur in the bill are that first the purchasing of sex is now made an A misdemeanor instead of a B misdemeanor. The selling of sex remains a B misdemeanor, but purchasing is elevated to an A. That's first. Second, if the person is convicted for a second time within a 5-year span, then there is a mandatory minimum also associated. It's 72 hours in jail. If the person is convicted for a third time within a 5-year period, it now becomes a Class C felony. So clearly the purchasing of sex is being treated very differently than the selling of sex. And that's a very intentional decision made by the administration in going through this. And so in that third column, I apologize that it's providing that information as listed there. But if you go down and look at footnote number 3, so you'll see prostitution as the little 3 next to it. If you go down to the footnote number 3, the only changes made to this statute in HB 68 is that the person, the patron of a sex worker under 2 would be a Class A misdemeanor, as I just discussed a moment ago, and the recidivist patrons of sex workers under 2 are elevated to a Class C felony. Again, what I was just describing in more detail. So I apologize, the column may not make it as clear, but the footnote is there to describe what I was just saying. It's in the bill.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Carpenter and then Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Mr. Skidmore,
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about 17-year-olds
mm-hmm.
who are engaging in what would be prostitution, but under this change, if there were 2 17-year-olds, would they then be engaging in a Class B or C sex felony?
Through the Chair to Representative Carpenter, I want to make sure I understand the hypothetical correctly. I have a 17-year-old selling and a 17-year-old purchasing. Is that okay? I see you nodding yes. The answer to the question then is that the 17-year-old who is selling could be guilty of the Class B misdemeanor of prostitution. The 17-year-old who is purchasing would be guilty of the Class A misdemeanor of prostitution. And as a first offense, the sentencing range is 0 days up to a year in jail. So that would be at the discretion of the court in those circumstances. Because it's an A misdemeanor, I would also note that that 17-year-old is not being prosecuted as an adult. That 17-year-old is being prosecuted in the by the Division of Juvenile Justice, and so it would be a juvenile crime. And I can't – we don't do a lot of those. I have a little bit of knowledge there, and I can help you out, but not prosecuted as an adult. In order for it to really come to my shop where we're going to be dealing with the sentencing – then you would have to change your hypothetical to the person purchasing being 18 or older, in which case, again, it is that Class A misdemeanor. Again, it can be as little as 0 time in jail or as much as up to 1 year in jail for that first offense.
Follow up.
Thank you. Madam Chair. So I'm reading the second column that says a person solicits a commercial sexual act, number two, which is an or from number one, from a person who is under 18 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to figure out under what circumstance the 17-year-old mm. that was buying and the 17-year-old that was selling didn't fall into this category. Someone.
Sorry, Mike. Good point. You're absolutely correct. I was inaccurate in my analysis there. It would be a patron of sex trafficking. So if you have the 17-year-old or the 18-year-old, either way, they would be guilty of the patron of a victim of sex trafficking under those circumstances. And in that situation, you're talking about a C sex offense. It doesn't change my answer about being handled by the Division of Juvenile Justice, because that is not a crime that transfers into adult court. And if it was an 18-year-old, that would be handled in the adult courts, but you are correct. Because the victim is under the age or of 18, or more precisely, the person selling is under the age of 18, that does fall in this other column.
And just to recap so that we're perfectly clear mm-hmm. about what we're talking about, the mm-hmm. person who is selling themselves
mm-hmm.
gets a lesser penalty
yes.
than the person who is buying.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Gray and then Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair, if someone is buying sex from someone who's under the age of 18,
okay,
and that person, the 16-year-old, for example, says that they're 18, it doesn't matter, correct? If the person selling sex lies about their age, it doesn't matter. If a person bought sex from somebody under the age of 18, it really wouldn't matter if that person lied. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, if you'll give me just one moment, I want to refer to the bill itself. I believe there's something in there about mistake of age and whether or not it qualifies, and I want to make sure I read that section to answer your question. So give me just one moment. So I'm looking on page 4, and I'm on line 14. In a prosecution under subsection A2, which is the patron of a victim of sex trafficking, somebody under the age of 18, it is an affirmative defense that at the time of the alleged offense, the defendant reasonably believed the person to be 18 years of age or older and undertook reasonable measures to verify that the person was 18 years of age or older. What's reasonable, again, is going to be that fact question that has to be proposed, but that, I hope, provides the answer to your question.
Follow up?
Yes. I guess I'm focusing back on level one, where I feel like this inclusion of the reckless disregard, I just think if we really wanted to stop sex trafficking, that we should put more responsibility on the person purchasing the sex, because I feel like reckless disregard gives them a big get out of jail free card, like a reckless disregard, like that they didn't look at all. You know, my fear is that just simply saying like, hey, you a victim of sex trafficking, and they, you know, a simple no, like, well, they passed the litmus test is what I would think, that it's no longer reckless disregard. So I was just curious about the inclusion of that word reckless. I just think it's kind of making an easy out.
Through the chair to Representative Gray, the reckless is the mens rea. The state of Alaska has identified 4 different mens reas, the highest being intentional, then knowing, then reckless, and then criminal negligence. Any crime has to have a mens rea. If it does not have a mens rea, it will not be a criminal statute. In fact, we have another statute in our criminal laws that say if there is not a mens rea specified, then it's knowing as to conduct and reckless as to circumstance. So it does have to be specified. Reckless is the second lowest. And I understand your concern, as you've articulated, about somebody asking and the person says no, and they're like, well, I guess it's okay. I come back to what I described earlier, which is even if that's occurred, we as the prosecutors will have to look at the totality of the circumstances, as would the jury, in deciding whether or not the totality of the circumstances says the person is reckless or not.
Representative Eastman, then Representative Groh.
Thank you, through the chair. The testimony that we heard earlier was to the fact that some victims of sex trafficking, in fact, many victims of sex trafficking don't recognize that they are in fact victims of sex trafficking. In fact, some of those we've heard from spent some number of years not recognizing the fact that they were a victim of trafficking.
Sure.
And I'm sure substance abuse issues don't help one thing clearly, usually, but in this, we're focusing a moment ago on the mindset of the patron.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent is the mindset of the person who's, you know, being sold play into this? Because if they get on the stand and say, at the time that this happened, I didn't realize I was a sex trafficking victim, which seems perfectly expectable, mm-hmm. You know, given what we heard, how does that not impact those types of prosecutions, regardless of whether or not, you know, the person asked if they were 18 or asked if they were a sex trafficking victim? It would seem to be very difficult to convince a jury about much if the person who's the victim mm-hmm. is saying, you know, under oath,
right,
I didn't think I was a victim, or at least I didn't think I was a victim of sex trafficking. How's this going to work?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, it's actually a very insightful question you're asking. I agree with you. That will certainly complicate any prosecution if the victim comes in and says, I don't consider myself to be a victim of sex trafficking. Does that mean that that case is unprovable? Again, forgive me for falling back on the same phrase again and again, but it's going to depend on the totality of the circumstances and what evidence is there available for us. Can I envision a scenario in which we are able to establish someone is a victim of sex trafficking, even though they don't think of themselves as such? Yes. Do I think that'll be further complicated? And do I think the jury will take pause if that victim comes in and testifies and says, I don't consider myself as such? Yeah, I think that's possible. But that doesn't mean that the case can't be proven. Those are just some of the facts, the realities that we as prosecutors will face if we try and prosecute or when we try and prosecute that particular crime.
Follow up. Thank you. I'm just trying to see if the language we have here currently appropriately accounts for those kind of eventualities. I mean, we heard even at one point that if someone comes looking for services and says, I'm a victim of sex trafficking, or I was a victim of sex trafficking, the response is, you're probably full of it, because that's not the way that people present themselves. You know?
Sure.
And so have we, in this language, sort of accounted for that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, you're asking me, is that accounted for? And the only way I know to respond to that is to say, these are the elements as it's been proposed by the administration. As always, in any time there's legislation, this is a give and a take. This is a dialogue, which I appreciate very much with you all. And if you all have other ideas about how to try to approach that, to address that problem, by all means, we're open to those conversations. We're open to those ideas that you all might have. That's what we hope, you know, always makes the legislation better. But this is what we've proposed at this time. This is the way we've proposed to address it. And if you all have some different ideas, we're all ears.
Thank you.
Flag in this question to piggyback off of Representative Eastman to have a discussion on coercion and mm-hmm. and the elements of coercion that I think play into getting to that solution. But I want to get to Representative Groh's question and continue on with the explanation of this chart, because it is 2:39, so we have 20 ripe minutes. So Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Skidmore.
Yeah.
We heard some accounts last Friday mm-hmm. that can be basically be only described as the product of evil. And I think that I'm not the only person, I'm convinced, around this table that basically thought that some of the perpetrators described would be fine with me personally, and I think others around here, if they died in prison. So, but I want to distinguish between that and some other conduct that's covered in this bill.
Okay.
And I want to, as I see it, I wanted to draw out, you know, your explanation. So I'm pointing to a section 4 of the House Bill 68 on page 3, sex trafficking in the third degree, which would be a new section. And there are three subsections of the first degree, very important, an unclassified felony, which, as I understand it, is the maximum penalty or the range of sentencing for
and classified felony, is that 20 to 99 years? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, the penalty for sex trafficking in the first degree under this bill is an unclassified felony that's a sex crime, and a sex crime has a presumptive sentencing range of 20 to 30 years for a first offense and a maximum of 99.
There you go. Thank you. And I note the first two sections in proposed AS 1141-340, numbers 1 and 2, one is has use of force or threat of force as an element. Mm-hmm. And the second one has, is also talks about being under 20 years of age in that person's legal custody. Mm-hmm. The third one is, quote, manages, supervises, controls, or owns, either alone or in association with others, a prostitution enterprise or a place of prostitution, unquote. And that does not reference either force or age. Is that correct? In the third subsection?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, yes.
Okay. I just want to note that that's not what we've been hearing about. These horrific tales last week of people in drug-induced stupors being beaten and being kidnapped repeatedly, you know, as they run away. That's not precisely what this third subsection is talking about. Is that correct in terms of an essential element of the crime?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I'm going to refer to the chart. I flipped to page 2 to help us out here. And we have the definitions that are found in the far left-hand column for sex trafficking. A place of prostitution means a place where a person engages in commercial sexual conduct in return for a fee, and the person is not the manager, supervisor, owner, or other person who controls the place. And so what this is really talking about is individuals that have a place that is used by others for purposes of engaging in all of these commercial sex acts. You are correct that that does not carry the elements of force or being in a person's legal custody or 20 years of age or younger, but it is providing the location in which this happens. It doesn't talk about how frequently, but it's providing that location for this to happen. The other one is prostitution enterprise, which is subsection 2 in this far left-hand column on the page 2 of the document that we provided you all. And prostitution enterprise means an arrangement in which two or more persons are organized to render sexual conduct in return for a fee. And again, in that situation, what you have now is multiple people that are providing sex in exchange for something of value, really. And in both of those instances, these are scenarios in which it is not an isolated incident or a single person, but rather this is now expanding it and bringing in multiple people engaged in the conduct. So while I agree with you, it is not force or a particular age of the person, it is talking about those instances in which the selling of sex is expanded and becomes far more, I don't want to say commercialized because that's not the right word, but it's the difference between someone who's just doing something for themselves and now the person has employees or is trying to make this a larger business. And once you take that next step in sort of elevating the business level of what you're engaged in, the risks of having individuals then that truly are the victim of sex trafficking, even though, as we heard Representative Eastman talk about the testimony that you all heard, most people would say, oh, I'm not a victim of sex trafficking. But in fact, they probably are, even if they don't recognize it in many instances. And so once you get to that higher level of commercialization, that's really what that other subsection is attempting to address. Again, I will note, however, as I was telling Representative Eastman just a moment ago, this is the administration's proposal. And if you all think that there's something in the wrong part of the bill or that the penalties ought to be different, then you all have the ability to propose amendments and see whether or not the rest of the committee agrees with those things. And we can work through that in the amendment process.
Sure. Follow up. Thank you. Mr. Skidmore, I wanted to ask us about a hypothetical question in terms of sex workers. If a sex worker provides another sex worker with a reference on a client as being good or bad, would that be considered organizing for commercial sexual conduct?
So the arrangement in which two or more people are organized, no, I don't think making references qualifies as organized. I think that's coming together in a single business, which I think of as different than one business making a recommendation to another business. It's sort of like having partners. And I don't know of any other way to frame this other than thinking of that business world and how other businesses operate. And sharing information back and forth doesn't make one organized, but if you are coming together as partners, then I think that does make you organized.
I'm just trying to say, in terms of like individual sex workers who may or may not be in the same business, but one gives essentially a business tip to another about whether this particular potential client is a is a good or bad client because of the broad definition of organizing for commercial sexual conduct in the proposed bill.
Well, through the chair, Representative Groh, you talk about a broad definition. I don't think that the bill provides a broad definition. I think that it says that they have to be organized, and how organized is ultimately interpreted, as you well know, is going to be a question of fact, which is then also a question of law that the courts and the juries are going to have to analyze. I'm telling you from my standpoint as a prosecutor, under the hypothetical that you've provided me, one person sharing tips with another, is that going to qualify as organized? My answer to you is, as a prosecutor, I'm not going to be comfortable charging that case. Whether or not, if I have another prosecutor who decides to charge that, what the jury thinks of that or whether the courts think that to be organized, those are unanswered questions as of right now, but I'd be skeptical as to how they would view those things, both the jury and the court.
One last follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Skidmore, there are various references to value here in this legislation.
Yes.
And there's a line drawn between $200 or more and less than $200.
Yes.
I take it that that's based on the market, the price that's charged. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I appreciate that question. It's not based on the value of what's charged. That was based on the concept of how much money does it take to move a person from one community to another. So in other words, if you needed to have a sex worker in Anchorage and you needed to fly him up to Fairbanks, how much would that cost you to move them from one location to another? That's how we derived $200. Whether that's a right demarcation between the two different levels is a policy question for you all. But the way we approached it is looking at what would it cost to get someone between major hub communities in Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Thank you, Madam.
Vice Chair Allard, and then Representative Gray.
Thank you, and through the chair. Mr. Skidmore, we didn't mention alcohol or kidnapping in this. We mentioned drugs or, let me look here, I think controlled substance. Is there a reason those two, it could be referenced somewhere else within the law? Just wondering, because on the testimonies that we heard Friday, it was clear that these women were trying to escape, and they were literally taken back, which would be kidnapping, I guess, by legal definition, perhaps. They're in a vehicle, they were running out of the vehicle, or they were in a house, they were trying to escape the house and brought back. And so I was wondering how come alcohol is left out of there? And why would we want to leave kidnapping? I'm sure you have a good reason. I just wanted it for clarification, please.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, in terms of alcohol, we didn't attempt to go to alcohol because providing alcohol, unless it's to a minor, is not in and of itself illegal. Doesn't mean that that's not a way in which coercion couldn't be accomplished. And what I would want to note is that in the definition, and again, I'm on page 2 of our chart here, inducing or causing another person to engage in the act in question includes. So the fact that alcohol is not mentioned doesn't mean that it can't be one of the factors that's considered. We've instead tried to provide a list of the types of things that qualify, but I think that alcohol is a slightly different analysis. If I'm giving cocaine to another person, that's illegal no matter what. If I give alcohol to somebody else, whether or not that's illegal is going to be dependent upon the person's age that I'm providing it to, and in providing it, whether or not I'm selling it to them, right? Other factors that would potentially make that illegal. In terms of kidnapping in and of itself is a different crime, which is found in Alaska Statute 1141-300. It is also an unclassified felony. And I think could cover some of the other conduct. Could kidnapping, again, be one of the factors that's considered in inducing or causing? My answer to you is yes, it absolutely can. The decision that the prosecution would have to make is whether or not they wanted to charge kidnapping as a separate offense in combination with the sex trafficking, or whether or not the kidnapping we wanted to use as a way in which the sex trafficking was committed. And those are strategic decisions about how to approach the prosecution. But I don't think that either kidnapping or alcohol are excluded from being considered. They just weren't necessarily one of the items that's listed here that tries to help provide that initial guidance. Are those things that could be added? Again, right. If you all wanted to add that to the list, you certainly could, but that's the reason we approached it the way we did.
Follow up? Yeah, through the chair. And correct, the reason I was asking about kidnapping and alcohol so many times, we hear, well, it wasn't in there. Or it depends how we're the bill is intent. And so mm-hmm. I want to make sure everything is checked off.
Sure.
But get my thoughts here for a second. Okay. And the $100 to the $200 or the $200,
mm-hmm.
I mean, gas prices, flights, you're looking at those numbers. But I mean, what I'm trying to say is if there was an alcohol or a kidnapping that was in here, could it be, for example, in the military, we have the military throws in the kitchen sink.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ran somebody over and went from the scene, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that can come. It can be dereliction of duty, late mm-hmm. to duty,
sure.
All sorts of things. So I was just wondering if this, with kidnapping alcohol, could it lengthen the time? Could they be charged with 20 years for trafficking, 15 years for kidnapping, 10 mm-hmm. years for alcohol? Do you see where I'm going?
I do, through the chair to Vice Chair Allard. And the answer to that question is potentially yes. That's what I was talking about when I said strategic considerations. You could charge a kidnapping separately from the sex trafficking, and then you get into that complicated legal analysis that I spoke of a little earlier about whether or not these two offenses merge because you're really talking about all the same conduct, or whether there are separate societal interests and whether we can draw distinctions between them. That sort of analysis, in my mind, is more complex, and I would need to look at it and study it and think about it to figure out how I, as a prosecutor, would want to approach that in what I think the courts might do with it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm kind of taking Representative Groh's line of questioning just a little further.
Mm-hmm.
With page 2, sex trafficking definition 2, prostitution enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
It is a hypothetical, but when I've read this just a couple of times, and I, if a patron calls a call number and asks the person who answers, can you come and can you bring a friend and I will pay you both the same amount? You know, I'll pay the full fee to both of you.
Okay.
And she calls her friend and says, hey, come with me. This is an easy job. We're both going to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like she's just organized her friend to participate in sexual conduct in return for a fee, which, I mean, I don't know if she caused another person to engage, but the person wouldn't have engaged if her friend hadn't called her and told her this job was there. This is a case where I fear, and I'm anticipating that what you're going to say is a prosecutor would never do that. But when I read the language, I think that it could unintentionally be, you know, however much we may unintentionally say that that's not what this is about,
mm-hmm.
that this woman who engaged her friend to go to this job with her could get this unclassified felony conviction. Is that impossible?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, I would not say that I would never charge that as a prosecutor, because what you described, I do think those two people are now organized, and I think it does lend itself to being charged in that way. Does that mean that the person would be convicted of that? Well, that would depend on what might happen in plea negotiations, and then that would depend on whether or not the court would agree that that's being organized, and then that would depend on whether or not you could get a jury 12 people to unanimously say, yes, that was organized as well. If you get through all of those hurdles, yes, that person could be convicted of an unclassified felony for that. Again, I come back to what I was telling Representative Groh a moment ago. If those are things that you think are not deserving of that level and should be someplace else, that's part of the dialogue. That's part of this process that we go through with you all of where do you think those things should be located in terms of classifications.
One follow-up, and then we can squeeze in a question by Vice Chair Allard.
I appreciate that. I do think I'd want to maybe offer an amendment here because I think that that woman would be safer by having her friend go with her. And so in this particular hypothetical, it's that the hypothetical I've described is the kind of the opposite of what we're trying to do with the bill. Human trafficking is terrible and we want to stop it. In this case of this independent contractor bringing her friend, they're safer together than they are alone. So I feel like we could tighten up that language. Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And just to do a follow-up in regards to what Representative Gray said, I've been in tons of emails regarding that situation. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm alarmed about that perspective is because I feel it can fall under the individual trying to avoid being an accomplice mm-hmm. and to try to shut the bill down. So I would disagree with Representative Gray mm-hmm. because I feel it's a sneaky move for some individuals to come in as an accomplice in a situation like that. But I would reach out. I would like you, if you could, here comes the question really quick. If you could we follow up with how we could, for me, I want this to go through. Mm-hmm. But I just want to make sure that it doesn't just get, I guess, I don't know if I could say it on public record. I don't want this bill getting killed over something like that. So I'm curious on why I'm getting inundated with those emails. And I know who all the background of this individual, and I'm just not excited about that. I feel like that's a maneuver to kill this bill. And I don't want that.
Through the chair to Vice Chair Allard, what I would tell you is that what I tell most legislators, when folks come and talk to you all, particularly about this subject area, I always encourage you all to be careful in looking at the sources and who's willing to come out and speak publicly about certain things. There are folks who come to the legislature every year and have been doing so since before this bill was originally introduced a number of years ago, who actually have it as a goal to try and legalize prostitution. And I've seen a letter that was submitted to you all that talks about this bill. And I think in the first three paragraphs I read, each and every one of those paragraphs is a misstatement of the law and what the bill says or what it does. So I appreciate the questions. I'm not disagreeing with Representative Gray about what could happen in the hypothetical that he presented me. But in terms of whether or not that is the sort of thing that you make significant policy changes on, again, I leave to you all to have those discussions amongst yourselves about what's most appropriate. But I always encourage you to consider the sources. I hope you all don't take everything that I say just as the gospel truth. I hope that you all do things to look at that and back it up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore, for your presentation and walking us through that very helpful chart. And I will now set House Bill 68 aside, and I'm setting an amendment deadline for this bill to be this Friday, March 24th, by 5 p.m. We are going to be continuing to hear this bill throughout the week and be able to have many more discussions. I encourage you to reach out to Mr. Skidmore and the Department of Law and also myself, because I have taken a lot of notes and a lot of conversations on this. So that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Wednesday, March 22nd at 1 p.m., where we will hear from Ms. Stacy Yates at My House Alaska, and then the committee will continue its work on House Bill 68. I would like the members to come prepared to talk about Sections 29 and 37 of the bill that specifically speaks to the vacation of judgment on certain convictions. That way we can be very methodical about how we go through this bill, since it does have a lot of moving pieces. We can talk about that. And then I want to make a note, on Friday we will be holding public testimony on this bill, and I encourage members to reach out to people in the community who want to be able to give their testimony. So seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let their record reflect. It is 3 p.m.